Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning are both award-winning journalists. They both also hail from the north and forged a friendship in Dublin in the 1970s when they worked on the Sunday World newspaper. Sam Smith, who has been named Journalist of the Year twice, is now a columnist with the Mail on Sunday. Eamon McCann has won an Amnesty International Award for his work on Bloody Sunday. He writes for Hot Press, the Belfast Telegraph and the Derry Journal. You're both very welcome here this morning. I actually didn't know you worked together on the Sunday World. Paint me a picture of what that was like 40 years ago.
Well, I could paint you bits of the picture. I mean, there's some of it has faded into obscurity, and mercifully so. No matter what anybody thinks of its politics or its attitudes, it was a wonderful place to work in the 1970s. It was sort of new, it was fresh, it was irreverent, it was on a wing and a prayer. And because of that, it sort of drew in and drew together a number of what you might call maverick journalist personalities.
And nothing like it had ever been seen before. If you looked at the other Sunday newspapers then, yeah, the Sunday Press, the Sunday Independent, both very solemn broadsheets, the sort of people who confuse earnestness with seriousness, which we didn't do in the Sunday World. And the Sunday World was the first colour paper. It was the first tabloid paper. And where its great success came, I think, was because people identified with it. It was very Irish. It was cheeky. It poked fun in your eye. And ultimately, it became a success, became a huge success.
Was it full of free spirits, like the pair of you?
Well, to an extent, it wouldn't have been true then of any other newspaper in Dublin, and I think it probably is today as well. I mean, because we were sort of seen as a sort of maverick newspaper, you know, by the journalistic establishment, a lot of people resented the Sunday World. An awful lot of people in the Irish Times and the Irish Independent and the Irish Press thought, not a proper newspaper at all.
And they patronised you.
Oh, they patronised. When I first became a political correspondent at this point of the Sunday World, I forget what year that was, I sort of automatically informed the press gallery. And I didn't get a response. I phoned him again. I said, because there was a room in Leinster House reserved for these distinguished people, the Paul Carrs, the political correspondents. They didn't accept me. I had to threaten to write to the Kyoncolia about them. They were appalled at the idea that this upstart from an upstart newspaper would come into their sanctum, sort of their holy of holies, sort of in Leinster House. Once I got admission to it, I never went in.
You didn't go in?
Never went into it in my life. Never set
foot. Was it because the newspaper also sometimes had scantily clad women, dare I suggest?
Well, the very first issue had a distinguished actress on the cover, Jeanne Crowley. Now, she was starting with her hands out. She was wearing a mini dress. It was very respectable. But it still comes up on pub quizzes. Who was the first pin-up on the front of the Sunday World? Jeanne Crowley was.
Beautiful Jeanne, yeah.
Yes, it was full of attractive women. But, I mean, that didn't detract from the seriousness of the stories we did. And we did, I think, some of the first investigative journalism of its type at the time. Listen, the ultimate jury is the public, yeah. And they bought it.
We still buy it.
Of course, there were newspapers coming in, News of the World, The People, The Sunday Express, were coming in from London with far more risque stuff. It was the fact that The Sunday World was Irish and that these people had been photographed that were actually Irish
and
girls.
And the slogan to sell it, which was, are you getting it every Sunday?
Yeah.
Which
great
at
slogan.
The time, people were giggling in pubs about it and that sort of thing.
Is it you who said that together you wrote the best tabloid sentence ever? You created a deux, the greatest tabloid sentence.
Do you remember? It's by Joyce McKinney, Sam. Do you remember this? The way she set about amassing the money to match. Perhaps you should explain who Joyce McKinney
He's
is.
Trying to
people
remember
don't understand.
Yeah.
Joyce McKinney was a woman who briefly was incredibly famous across these
days. American woman.
She's an American woman, and she had been in love with a Mormon chap in America. He was taken from her and sent by his church to proselytize, and if that's the word, sort of in England. She followed him, having raised enough money on the streets, as it were, to follow him, hired an assistant. Kidnapped him, chained him up, took him to a cottage, sort of in rural Wales, and had her way with him. But the sentence was, the way she set about amassing the money to manacle her Mormon told more about the morals of Ms. McKinney than anything the media man who'd made her a martyr had ever imagined. As I recall, Mr. Smith, myself, Sammy, myself, I think it was a joint production because we're sitting opposite one another saying, how about this? What about it? And we eventually come up. I nominate that as the best tabloid sentence ever written, and we are the co-writers of it.
That's the sort of place that the Sunday World was. It was really fascinating.
Do you remember meeting him for the first time, or your first impressions of Mr. Sam Smith beside you, Eamon?
Yeah, and I'm not quite sure that he does, because I think you said that we met at the Sunday World. We met before that. We met in court. It would have been as early in Derry. That I was being charged.
Sam suddenly going, what?
I was being charged with, I forget what, but it was something to do with the early days of the civil rights movement.
No doubt, disorderly conduct.
Disorderly convict, or convict likely to lead to
I came up
the
with
own
Vincent
sense of democracy. That's exactly, the late Vincent Hanna was, late Vincent Hanna was my solicitor, and Vincent was not a man to travel incognito. He arrived with an entourage. And among the entourage was Sam Smith. So we met in the court while I was waiting to discover what my fate would be. So we met in auspicious and dramatic and historically significant circumstances.
Do you remember that now, Sam?
I do now, because I was driving two British Labour MPs, Russell Kerr and someone else, up because Gerry Fitt had been organising British MPs. Believe it or not, I was a sort of peripheral supporter, member of the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association with my friend Vincent Hanna, and that would have got me involved in that. And paradoxically, while we were doing great historic things, Vincent Hanna also started a show business agency called Pentagon Promotions, called the Five-Sided Figure Shines Brightly, if I can remember it now. And we used to bring over all these acts from America,
bands,
Britain, and
stuff.
And so on. Oh, big acts. And we toured them around. And it was like when I was 17, I was in show business full time.
Of course, your backgrounds are very different. I'll get yours in a moment, Sam. You grew up in Derry, didn't you, Amy?
Yes, I did indeed. I grew up in the Bogside, from Rossville Street in the Bogside. My father was a labourer. He worked for the British Navy at what's now known as Fort George in Derry. And he was a very active trade unionist. That's
where you get it, yeah.
Basic memories from that time, sort of, is that the house was always full of trade unionists discussing this crisis or that crisis. The situation in the North, even back then, it's never been as simple as it appears to be. I mean, my father was a Labour man. His big hero was Norman Bevan. If you look at photographs of the first ever civil rights march in the North in Derry, October 1968, you'll see placards which say, "Tories are vermin, Norman Bevan." Norman Bevan was the Labour Minister who brought in the National Health Act, and when the Tories opposed it, he said across the chamber in Westminster, "Tories are vermin." My father loved that, and that's where that slogan came from, which is on the civil rights banners on October the 5th, 68. My father's proudest boast was, and he would say it frequently, there never was a nationalist vote went out of this house. He never would have voted nationalist. And yet when people look back at it now, they say, the Bogside, well, that's a nationalist area. Actually, the vote just split 60-40 between the Nationalist Party led by Eddie McAteer in my young days and Labour led by Stephen McGonigal, subsequently the Ombudsman in the North. So that's sort of my background. And I'm always aware sort of like that it contradicts sort of the standard narrative, which we just have it, that there were Catholic nationalists and Protestant unionists, two communities with their own trajectories alongside one another. To some extent, that was true. It was never the whole truth.
That's much more interesting, though, isn't it? I mean, there was much more complex, as you say, than most people assume. And yet, I suppose, a number of people of your generation, because of the civil rights situation, did opt to go towards violence. You never did. Why? Was that because of your father, do you think? Or how come you never slipped into that?
Oh, not only did I not slip into it, honestly, I always opposed it. And I remember many, many arguments, sometimes literally all-night arguments, with friends of mine who had started them just broadly socialist and so on, and moved towards, usually towards the official IRLs. For some, that was a stopping off point, sort of on the way to the Provos or to the INLA. Now, it wasn't a moral objection to violence. It was a political thing, which I suppose to some extent I got from my father, but I always knew, if there's one thing I knew that nothing was going to come out of this armed struggle commensurate with the sort of the investment of pain and misery and grief, sort of, and death accepted and death inflicted, just nothing. And I believe I was proven right about that. Now, that's not to say that the vast majority of people that I know who went into paramilitary organisations and some of them did dreadful things, the vast majority of them did so for decent reasons. And that, on all sides, they really did. But it was something that politically I was always opposed to. It changed my mind about lots of things down through the years, or wobbled on this or that point. I've never deviated from that.
You've a completely different background, Sam. East Belfast?
North Belfast. My father was unemployed for much of my youth, never voted unionist in his life,
Protestant family?
Yep. Protestant raised Methodist, Baptist Church of Ireland raised Methodist, actually something that probably has stuck to me because there are still values, very simple ones, but some things are right, some things are wrong. It's not that hard to confuse them. But I grew up through there. My brother joined the British Navy, and I can remember his party piece at family gatherings was to sing Kevin Barry, which he knew from beginning to end, which didn't make him the most popular boy in town. And yes, and I remember when I was about 10, him sitting down to me, he says, do you realise that in Derry there's twice as many Catholics as there are Protestants, yet there's twice as many Protestants selected than there are Catholics? And even at that age, and I was not a particularly bright child, I remember thinking, yeah, that does seem unfair. So there was always an undertow, I would like to think, around the house of fairness. My mother worked all of her days. She mainly worked for Jewish people and became very friendly with the Jewish community in Belfast. She worked working as a presser in the garment industry. And we had a fairly good life. There was one small boy who went to school with me. I'll not say his name, but anyway, he often bled my nose and I wasn't allowed to play with him and told to avoid him at all costs. A rough boy. He later, I remember, because I was living in Dublin at the time, my mother saying to me, you know, so-and-so down the street. Yeah, he says, do you know, he was convicted of murder recently and he murdered someone. And such was the thing around the area at the time. And we lived in a relatively respectable area, people said. His mother came round and told her neighbours, you know, he only took the rap for that because the fellow who did the shooting was married with a family and it seemed very unfair. Now, people, it was quite daft, but people were prepared to believe that sort of thing. That was part of the troubles.
Did it ever make any difference? This sounds really simplistic, that you were a Catholic and you were a Protestant.
No, as far as I'm concerned, it didn't, you see. And I've only thought about this sort of recently, looking back on it, is that one of the reasons perhaps where we sort of hit it off is that Sam's from a Protestant background, but not a Unionist. I'm from a Catholic background, but I'm not a nationalist. And there's something almost liberating about that, to realise that you don't have to be.
Fit into a
script,
box.
Yes, what the script says that you ought to be. And there's a lot of people like that in the North, you know. There's a whole lot of things about
absolutely.
The North.
But Eamon, I often felt, had part of his youth denied, because I knew how much he loved rock and roll. Eamon just loves popular culture, popular music. I was very much involved in it because I managed bands. I was involved in running these gigs. And that was a great common denominator between us too. We really
showbiz, rock and roll. Absolutely. Who was Lord Turk?
I was Lord Turk.
You were Lord Turk.
Yeah.
And how come you became Lord Turk? And pray tell me, what did Lord Turk do?
Well, my best friend growing up, actually, was a fellow. Well, when I became a teenager, it was a fellow called Donal O'Corrivain. Now, Donal's family, his father was actually in the GPO in 1916, a very hard ticket to get, as I understand it. But Donal O'Corvin lived in a very middle-class suburb of Belfast, in Finney, and he never spoke English until he was seven. It was an all-Irish-speaking house.
And was he a Protestant himself?
No, he was Catholic and from a traditional Irish Gaelic background. But he was a disc jockey in Belfast. He used to wear a purple suit.
Cool.
He and I became very close friends. And he first came to Dublin. He would be one of the reasons. Because when those troubles were going, Miriam, you know, everybody thought that I would meet, I presume, and Eamon says, you know, in 6 months this will all be over and things will go back the way they were. Sometime about 1972, I spotted, no, this is not going to happen. And Donal O'Corvin had already moved to Dublin and I went down to manage him. And actually, he was down here. He wrote in a music magazine, as I did at that time, called Spotlight. That's where I switched to journalism. And he was very pally with lots of people, but Luke Kelly was one of them. And he insisted that Luke Kelly record this song. It was a Kink song, which Donald really loved, called Thank You for the Days. And Luke was very sceptical of this. He was quite the purist. And Donald brought the tune to him.
And you were the Lord Turk?
Well, I was Lord Turk and he was Nick the Greek for some reason. I could never figure out much myself. And these were sort of nom de plumes who would use putting ads in the paper for various things, events, rock and roll events. And we also ran a thing called Pop for Peace, which, when you think of it now, it's...
Well, Belfast Castle, was it?
No, it was in Shaw's Bridge in Belfast. But we got the Tremolos, the Marmalade, big British bands of
Marmalade.
The time.
Wowie.
This was in 69 to try and stop, because it did look like an express train coming, the Troubles, at the time. And this juvenile and very naive notion to try and stop it, we ran it. Tens of thousands turned out. It was on ITV, I think it was on American TV and all the rest. But there was nothing stopping the Troubles.
So, but for the so-called Troubles, you could have been a band manager forever in a purple suit.
I don't know about the purple suit, but I certainly would have been a promoter of some sort. Yeah. And then, of course, I became the director of entertainment for the city of Belfast at the height of the Troubles, 1970 to 72, which I would actually probably like as my tombstone. You know,
we're going to take that first piece of music.
Thank you for the days.
Thank you for the days, those endless days, those sacred days you gave me. I'm thinking of the days. I won't forget a single day, believe me. I bless the light, I bless the light that lights on you, believe me. Now you're gone, you're with me every single day, believe me.
Luke Kelly there, thank you for the days. Oh, beautiful voice, beautiful song. But before you ever went into journalism or band management or entertainment, you were an apprentice electrician, weren't you?
I was. My mother wished for nothing more than me to get a trade, settle down.
Sensible woman.
And get sense. And actually, I did. But around the same time, when I was 15, 16, I began managing bands, which does seem precocious, and I was precocious beyond belief. But it got to the point where I was actually making a good deal of money from the bands. Mm. And same as my, you know, my education was littered with me mitching school, when I started working, I had to mitch work, because I was making so much money, or not so much, I was making quite a few quid, I suppose, off bands and gigs and so on, that before I went home in the evening, I used to have to go into the gutter and dirty my hands and my face as if I'd been at work all day, because my mother would have been very disappointed when I came home, if she thought. And I wouldn't have disappointed her, because I do still love my mother very much. And I'm not sure she ever found that out.
Not that I'm revealing Mrs. Smith's age, but I am. Isn't she in her mid-90s?
She is, and heading for her 96th on June the 9th.
Totally aware of what's happening, and
she is, sadly, she stopped smoking on her 84th year. But occasionally looks at me longingly and asks me for a cigarette occasionally.
That is so funny. It's in your genes. And you ended up in Las Vegas when you were 20, I suppose.
I did.
Your mother's heart. What was that like?
Just sensational. I'd been to London once, I think, with Vincent Hanna, but I'd never been to America or anything, and went straight to Las Vegas. And at that time, it was a mob town. It was controlled by the mafia. And the Royal Show Band were playing there. And it was just the best time you could have. Young guy at that age. The local band and the local disco were Sly and the Family Stone, who were terrific. I remember Tony Bennett inviting me to a party, which was
amazing.
And I went dressed as a matador. I can remember, it was a fancy dress party. But
Meanwhile, Eamon, you were pruning trees in London, is this correct?
Yes, I was a tree pruner and transplanter. We pruned trees in the spring and the summer, then you transplant them in winter when the sap wasn't rising. That's the way you have to do it. It was the best job I've ever had. I mean, I absolutely adored that. It was hard work at times. I mean, in the winter, you had to dig up trees I get them up early in the morning because we're taking them through London, sort of in the back of a sort of specially constructed carrier at the back of them. And so you couldn't do that in the rush hour. So we usually pick them up in Hainault Forest, in Essex or at Epping, usually about 30-foot high trees, which is what we transplanted. And we'd have to get there by 6 in the morning. So we usually started about 5 o'clock. Sort of, and I was the only non-Cockney in the job. It was absolutely wonderful. We sang every morning. We sang all the way sort of across London. We had 2 songs for them. One was Jerusalem. Cool. You know, did those feet in ancient times. All the Cockneys knew all the words. So joined them with gusto. Cool. And the other was, "Don't laugh at me because I'm a fool," Anthony Newley. And we could sing those sort of with great gusto and heart. And we did the transplanting in the winter, as they say. And then we did the pruning and so on. And that was just clambering up and down trees. Imagine getting paid for that. And we all got on very well together. There was 13 of us in the gang. And I was at that for about 2 years. And I don't think the gang ever changed. It was the same 13 people. And we all got to know one another. And I spent a lot of time down the old Kent Road. I used to drink in a pub called the Thomas Becket. Very famous, Cockney pub. And we'd gather there sort of on Friday nights. And I'd never see them now, but I still remember all of those guys. One thing that did for me, if there ever was a chance of me being sort of anti-English in the sense of thinking that English people were horrible, so they were, all those Cockneys, they actually conformed to the caricature. They all were sort of very warm and together. They were very witty. They had lore, sort of a background and so on. They're absolutely wonderful. I mean, sort of, had it not been for the trouble, I only left that job when I came back to Derry for a couple of weeks because my sister was back from Winnipeg. She hadn't been back for 5 years since she left. And I arrived back in Derry and I was only going to be back for 5-6 days. And the night before I was to go back, I met an old friend, Dermy McClanahan. He's in the Labour Party in Derry. And he said, "We've got a bit of thing going on here, Eamon, about housing with people in a caravan. Do you fancy coming along?" I went along, then I stayed another couple of days. I was living with a wonderful woman in London at the time, Olivia, and we had a nice house and I had a job that I loved and so forth. I had no intention ever of leaving it, and I just bumped into Dermot McClanahan and I haven't looked forward since.
And so Olivia's still waiting for you.
Not when Olivia's very, she's not. I did see her after about 20 years of started seeing her again and talking to her on the phone.
She probably wanted to kill you at the time, but hey, I'm sure she's forgiven you now.
Yeah.
You were that generation, of course, that the Education Act meant so much for. I mean, it's a cliche to talk about it, but you went to St. Columb's, that brilliant school, first of all, in Derry, that's produced so many brilliant guys. And then you went to Queen's.
The thing about St. Columb's now, St. Columb's produced a lot of brilliant people. I don't think it really did, but
I've interviewed so many of you.
I don't think St. Columb's didn't make us. I think what happened was that in St. Columb's you had the sudden influx sort of unkempt people from the Bogside mainly because of the 11 plus. We were let know very
quickly.
Well,
the Butler Act, wasn't it?
The Butler Act, yes. Which got us all in sort of to that place. My very first day at St. Columb's, a priest was going around the class, like, "What's your name? Where are you from? What's your name?" He came to me, he said, "What's your name, McCann? Where are you from? Rossville Street." He said, right off how he says, "Oh, Rossville Street, that's where you wash once a week." At 11 years old. Now, that was letting me know my place, sort of literally. And I think sort of what happened in St. Columb's is there was a particular period there, and you had this influx of people. It was sort of the clash between sort of the ideology of St. Columb's and the way it tried to enclose everybody sort of in that area, and a sudden incursion of people who couldn't be enclosed. And I think it was in the abrasion between sort of those two things that sparks began to fly. Left to its own devices, St. Columb's would not have produced any of the distinct people that it did produce.
It's really interesting. You didn't go to university, Sam, and you could have. Could you have?
I was just totally turned off school. I was no good at it. And what I did was, I went to a number of schools. I went to, and ended up going to school in the centre of Belfast, which, of course, was 5-minute walk away from the plaza, which had lunchtime sessions where records would play, and my head was turned with rock and roll. I suppose I absolutely adored rock and roll, listened to records every minute I could, wanted to be involved. When some local guys were starting a band, I was right in the middle of it, the College Boys. They ultimately became quite successful. They went on to manage other bands and so on. I had no real interest in anything else at that time. There was the minor business of civil rights and so on, but I was just absolutely, hypnotised by show business.
You're fastidious about grammar, aren't you, Eamon McCann?
I try to be. I'm not saying that I never make grammatical errors myself. I come from a background which I learned Latin, and I was quite good at
Sam
Latin.
Sam is
and
laughing.
Greek.
You never finished a sentence with a proposition.
Oh, or even a proposition. I really get upset when I see apostrophes used wrongly and so on. When people write 1980s and there's an apostrophe between the zero and the S, it just drives me mad. Why is there an apostrophe there? What does it mean? It's not a possessive thing, you know.
No.
I hate that, and I hate sort of hanging participles, and I just hate generally, and the way in which people casually use, you know, singular subjects and then a plural verb. You know, you could hear it in RTE News. You hear them say, "I heard it just a couple of nights ago."
Go on.
What do you call it? The government are. The government are intending. It's not no one government. The government is. You know, nice simple things that got to me. And there's a point to this, you know. If you read Orwell, sort of, on political uses of language, sort of, when people are imprecise in their use of words and in the way they structure sentences, it means that they've been imprecise in their thinking and their categories. Sort of.
Yeah,
they can't
enough.
Be clear. Sort of. And there's a reason why, and that's one of the reasons why I think that we'll not have education back on a proper footing until Latin is taught again in the schools, I mean, which it never should have been abolished.
Miriam, don't get him started on the split infinitive. Or we'll be here all week. Well, he was like that, like to work alongside him.
Oh, sorry, it's your news editor.
Yeah, well, I had little difficulty with that, although I had barely an education. But if you can read, you can write, you know. And the other bits, you know, it's not too hard to find out about the aberrant apostrophe and so on, as he was talking about there. But Eamon would have been quite fussy about that. And the writing in the Sunday World actually, in many ways, is more difficult than it is in the big broadsheets, because you have to put a lot more information into a lot less space.
You've gone back to Derry. You live there now, don't
yes,
you?
Indeed.
Why did you make the decision to go back there?
Well, I'm not sure if I ever actually made a decision. There wasn't a day when I said to myself, right, I'm going to go back and live in Derry again. I left Derry again in the 1970s. I went to London with my partner Mary Holland, a distinguished journalist at the time. Mary was pregnant with our first child, Kitty.
Another brilliant journalist.
Of whom I'm inordinately proud. So I did, it was the right thing to do. I mean, our second child, Luke, was born over there. Despite that, I don't think there ever has been an occasion when I've been out of Derry for more than, say, 6-7 weeks at a time. I've always been back, going back.
Do you love it?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. And I now live about 150 yards from the house in which I was born. You know, the people I hang out with are, some of them are people that I've known literally all my life, and they know me and know everything about me, and I really enjoy that.
You know, one of the things that I could recommend, or one thing that I could recommend, is when you move cities. Moving cities, moving, for instance, in my case, from Belfast to Dublin. When you move to a new city, people don't regard you as they do. If you're a Dubliner in Dublin, other people, and where are you from? What end of the city are you from?
Where'd
who's
you go to
that
school,
and who are you related to and so on? And in a couple of sentences, I'd have you well wrapped up, boxed, and know who you are, all about you, and seed, breed, and generation. When you arrive in from somewhere else, people can't make such assumptions. And they have to take you more as, you know, how they find you. So that I find quite comfortable with. The one thing Eamon was saying there that I remember very well that I think actually gave us some form of bond was we had daughters born within a few weeks of
each other,
in 1988.
Mm-hmm. What's your daughter's name, Sam?
Fela,
yeah.
And, I remember that. And we weren't young men at the time. We could both change a nappy with one hand, I expect, if pushed.
Excellent.
But, you know, that was something at that time. And I remember at that time, Eamon had gone back home. The Sunday World days had their day. And we had moved on. I had moved on then to other things, to the Irish Independence Zone. And I remember admiring Eamon for moving home. I'm not sure I could do it as easily, but
never say never.
The right thing for Eamon. Yeah. Never say never.
But look, we're going to take the next piece of music first. Eamon, your choice.
Is it Paddy Nash and the Happy Enchiladas? It's a song called Martin. Paddy Nash is, to my mind, the best songwriter writing in Ireland at the moment. A good friend of mine. And the song Martin is about a friend of his who committed suicide. His real name's not Martin. And Paddy wrote this as a sort of tribute. I think it's a wonderful song.
When we were young, we had a secret shake of hands. We watched young guns in the Strand. We sang Cowgirl in the Sand. Me and Martin.
That was Paddy Nash and the Happy Enchiladas with Martin. That's a beautiful song, and he's a beautiful voice, actually, Eamon. We're going to take a break. Join us in a few moments.
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Follow the programme on Twitter at Miriam Meets. Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. I'm here this morning with great friends and great journalists Sam Smith and Eamon McCann. I always think there's something different about Northerners.
Oh yeah, we're better.
You're different. You're better.
Well, I don't know. I'll tell you something. There is a truth in that, which is that people in the North, sort of, whether they're back in Catholic, Protestant, Nationalist, Unionist, neither, whatever they are, atheist or whatever, we've come through an intense experience which is not shared by anybody across the water, and which isn't really shared. I know horrible things have happened in Dublin and the South as well, but it hasn't been lived through. It hasn't sort of enclosed your life sort of in the way that it has in the North. And even while fighting with one another, sort of, there's that shared understanding, sort of. And I think there's almost a common resentment against people from outside, I mean, presuming to prescribe solutions and so on in the North, which does pull people together, like as if we know what it's about, you know, sort of, particularly in Belfast.
Yeah, you know, one thing people often say is that he's often, I think, perhaps our greatest talent in the popular arts in this country was Van Morrison.
If you were to ask the question that name the authentic geniuses of popular culture who have come out of Ireland, or at the island of Ireland, say in the last 50, 60 years, I think there's probably no more than 10, probably fewer. Three of them certainly are George Best, Hurricane Higgins, and Van Morrison. Mm. What have they got in common? All tight wee prods from working class backgrounds in Belfast. And all of them found it very difficult, and still, Van Morrison, to none of them acted the celebrity. None of them knew quite how to do it. I mean, George Triton was a disaster, of course. I mean, Hurricane Higgins never, ever could act the celebrity. Even at the height of his fame, when he was world champion again the second time in 1982, and he was being interviewed, none of that smoothness about him. He couldn't do, excuse the term, no way Bono can speak fluent bullshit. You know, sorry, it's a natural for him. He's a native speaker. You know what? There's no way that any of those three people. I used to urge him to write a book which would have been a joint biography of these three people, born within a couple of years of each other.
Great idea.
I did write a feature about it.
You wrote a feature about it.
I did write a
feature
about it.
There's a book in that, and since I'm too old to keep agitating Sam about it, and he's probably too old to undertake it at the minute, it's an idea there for somebody. There is a brilliant book.
I do have a son who writes in the Financial Times.
Jamie, another great journalist.
I might pass that on to him as a millstone around his neck.
But is it something in the Protestant DNA? I mean, do you enjoy the success you've had? Have you managed to enjoy it?
Yeah. Oh, I have, and I've had fairly good success. Well, I'm not particularly rich, but I do enjoy my life. I've made great friendships, which I really value. And most of them have come about through journalism now. And showbiz, actually. Showbiz is still there. I still have dinners from time to time with my showbiz friends. But God, it's been a great life.
I think
really
he's sad he left the showbiz world, actually.
Indeed.
Do you, Eamon?
Yeah. He was made for it.
What I like about you both, particularly you, Eamon, is you never lost your spirit for, you know, speaking out about things you don't mind. You've never lost that passion.
No, I haven't, and it's too late to stop now, I suppose. And
but some people get weary, don't they?
Well, I don't get weary. I get physically weary, I have to say, running around an awful lot of the time. I never get weary of the struggle, because that's what keeps me going. And then, I mean, for the last 25 and more years, in fact, I mean, my partner, Gretty Horgan, if I ever began to wilt, you know, would sort of spur me on, sort of.
Are you happy in your life?
Am I happy in my life? I'm happy in my personal life, you know, sort of. I've got Kitty and Luke, my two older children, but Matty, who's 25, and I have with Gretty, and Matty's got a lot of problems, but she's a joy. And she's a happy child as well, sort of. So it's her and Gretty and myself live in the heart of the Bogside, And I'm happy.
Did it change you having a child who did have problems?
Oh, I think it did. I suppose I find it difficult to quantify the changes or even to identify them all. But certainly, Matty was a near-caught death, as I say, at 11 weeks. You know, and she was in a coma for weeks after that, you know, and she suffered damage, as you do when there isn't oxygen going to the brain for a while and so on. And I remember actually sort of when we were, you remember Sam, you came up to Belfast sort of when Matty was in the Royal Hospital for Sick Children on the Falls Road, when it wasn't clear if she was going to make it at all, you know, and Coretti and I were actually staying in the hospital sort of with her, and Sam arrived up from Dublin, I remember, and we spent a few days and had a pint on the Falls Road and had sort of a... You wrote, while we were doing that, it was, I tell you what day it was, Ireland had just beaten Britain in Germany. It was on how to score the goal. Yeah. Sammy had to write stuff, and he said, I really have to write a piece about this. For the Star, it was, in fact, if I remember rightly. And he wrote, he sat down in the midst of all this and wrote a brilliant tabloid intro, which was, Kermit the Frog said it best, it's not easy being green, but it's a little bit easier this morning, folks. Now, what a perfect... I remember that. And he said, what do you think of that? And passed it. In the midst of all the sadness and pain. And I said, I remember that absolutely vividly, having a great laugh.
But that's a true friend, that you did go up.
I remember having my daughter, Faye, had been born roughly the same time. And I was very disappointed for Eamon and Coretti that they'd have to go through all of this. And why not? You know, I mean, I'm from Belfast, not very far away, and I was concerned. I hoped not that I could make much of a difference, but I suppose I can imagine them being in the hospital. It's very claustrophobic, and you come up, at least you provide some sort of relief of some sort. No, it's just the least you can do.
And your own daughter has cystic fibrosis, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does, Faye, and. Mm. She wasn't diagnosed with that until she was 5. And she has been a revelation to me and a great joy to me in everything that she's done. It has not impinged on her life as much. I can remember when people have asked her to do this, that, and the other because of her having CF, her saying to me, well, actually, that's probably not a good idea because I wouldn't want to be defined as that girl with CF. It's a sophistication and certainly a maturity probably beyond me. So,
and you two, like Eamon, are very happy in your personal life. Your fundamentals are good, as I always
think so.
Say.
Yeah, I've got, if not perfect, as good a perfect or as perfect a life as anybody could ever hope to have. I have no complaints. I've had difficulties in my professional life, which have been, you know, came late in the day. For instance, I've had great success in journalism and, you know, making my way through life, and then things changed. You know, I'm no longer working for Today FM, where I used to do a Sunday morning current affairs programme. I did work for the Irish Independent. I no longer do. I'm now very happy in the Mail on Sunday.
You forged your relationship, of course. We started at the beginning talking about the Sunday World. Mm. A lot's been written about the death of newspapers. The future is online.
Like my pension to be invested in newspaper shares, I'll put it to you that way. Now, things are changing, and a lot of what you see is what the generation before me didn't like change. I don't particularly like change, but I really don't like what's happening. I think things are going to change. Miriam, I think, for instance, you're involved in broadcasting. I think you're going to have much more narrow casting in the future, where people will be, you know, focusing on specific groups of people. I think that magazines and newspapers, for the want of a better word, will be directed at, you know, specific groups, and people are interested in those things. I think it might go that way. Now, how everybody pays for that is going to be another day's work. But I do think we're in for a lot of change. But I do believe that there still will be journalists there, either putting the news together or putting together analysis and opinions.
Because there's always going to be people like me who want to read great articles and great features. So I'll go looking for them.
I'm a bit of a skeptic about the new media. I'm not sure that in the long term it's going to... be as sort of dramatic as it might appear to be. I'm struck with the fact that, for example, the number of people in the state using Facebook has now sort of gone into decline over the last 2 years. Has been a steady decline. The number of journalists using Twitter.
Yeah, but Eamon, you answer me something. I know you're doing, Mariam. What's the difference between tweeting and narcissism?
I don't know. I don't do because
not everyone tweets just about themselves. Yeah. But I know what you
mean.
An
awful lot of them do.
They're the boring ones.
But think over the last day. Look, this country. Look across the water. Look in the States. Across the world. I mean, I cannot think of really big stories breaking other than in the traditional media. Your stuff, Sam, I mean, which has a huge effect on Irish politics as well as journalism, all sort of in traditional...
But they're big investigations. I think stuff like the Arab Spring, I mean, I do think, for a breaking story, it's fascinating.
Well, in the Arab Spring, and so Twitter may have played a role, sort of, in social media generally, played a role, sort of, in the events developing. But reporting them and analysing, it has been appallingly bad.
I agree.
I mean, insofar as people depended on those things.
Yeah.
One of the reasons everybody's confused now about what is happening in Libya and so on is precisely that there weren't sort of old-fashioned journalists with their boots on the ground filing copy at night.
But look, as we come to the end, I'm interested in the fact you used to be a religious affairs correspondent. Yeah. Do you have faith? Are you spiritual? Do you believe in God?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. No. I've been an atheist.
Great religious affairs correspondent.
Not at all. I've got no belief whatsoever in God. I mean, I just...
Not at all.
It's just ridiculous. I mean, sort of, I don't mean to offend anybody, but it just seems to be self-evidently ridiculous. That's not to say that I'm not interested in religion. I am, because if you're an atheist, as I am, then the phenomenon is fascinating. And what are the roots of it? What generates these different beliefs? Why do they express themselves differently one place and another, one time to another, and so forth? It's really, really interesting. You know, it's an awful lot of the religious people I know don't know very much about religion. You talk to Catholics in this country. You talk to them about the Bible. They know nothing about it.
Protestants are good in the Bible, aren't you?
They're not better than Catholics. Not difficult. Atheists are better than Catholics. Hears.
Yes, I can quote you large bits from the Bible, but they're learned by rote. They're not learned by analysis and learning and so on. Now, I'm not particularly a religious person myself. Unlike Eamon, I wouldn't be arrogant enough to say no God exists. All I would say is that I really don't know, but I'd be surprised, and I hope I'd be pleasantly surprised. But all the evidence points to, you know, when it's over, it's over.
If I was to ask you as we close, one thing you'd each say at each other's funeral, which hopefully won't be for the next 60 years, what would you say to sum up Sam Smith?
Yes, Sam?
Yeah.
But right at the heart of them, there was sort of an unvanquishable decency, and that's a very good quality to have.
Sam, what would you say about Mr. McCann?
The most intelligent journalist I ever worked with, bar none, and probably the best fun it's possible to have on a night out.
That's so sweet. I think you should, maybe you should get married to each other. Except you're happy already. Perfect. Yes. Look, there's a piece of music. What is it you're choosing for the end you both want?
Well, I think we had a chat during one of the breaks there, and we've come...
A lot of thought goes into this programme.
Yes, we do. But we think it's a band from Derry. It's called My Perfect Cousin by The Undertones, and I think it sums up best a lot of the people we don't like.
Great song. But look, my thanks on sound today to Bryony October, to my producer Eileen Heron. I've loved having you both. Eamon McCann, safe journey back to Derry. Sam, safe journey to Sandymount, wherever you go. Thank you all very much for listening. We'll go out listening to the wonderful Undertones.
Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.